Good morning. On Wednesday, as the world watched, the Taliban took over Kabul and held a press conference.
Different countries of the world have their own laws, have their people live according to their laws, and so do the Afghans have the right to live under their own laws. The issue of women is an important issue. We recognize the rights of the women which Islam gave them. Women can work, they can go to the school, they can work in schools, they can work in hospitals. We assure the world that there will be no excesses against the women, and everything will be done under the Islamic laws.
On Monday, US President Joe Biden also gave a press conference.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there. We were clear-eyed about the risk. We planned for every contingency, but I always promised the American people that I would be straight with you. The truth is, this did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated.
On Tuesday, Philip spoke to Mahbuba Siraj of the Afghan Women's Network.
There were three words there that I suspect might end up coming to define his presidency, or at least his foreign policy. He said that the government collapse came quicker than expected, from which it's reasonable for us to infer that they expected the Afghan government and army to collapse and for the Taliban to sweep to power in this way, just not as quickly as it ended up happening. What are your feelings about that calculation?
Oh, dear God. Again, that's one of those words, like his gut feelings, that just makes me absolutely crazy. Mr. President, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean by expected, earlier than expected? You were expecting Afghanistan to fall in the hands of the Taliban and be destroyed? Is that the name of the game, Mr. President? Is that what you do? What is this? I don't get it. What is he saying? Please tell me, what is he saying to the people of the United States? Is he saying what? We go into a country, we stay there for 20 years, we get the women on their feet, we get the country on its feet, whichever way we did it. You know, we do that. And then at the end, we run out and we expect it to fall in the hands of the people that we've been fighting for 20 years with. And we don't even have any remorse, any thought, thinking process. The only thing that we are saying to our people is that, well, they were taken over, and it was really unexpected. Instead of the 6 months that we were expecting, they happened to be in their hands in 4 days. Is this the way the world is run now?
On Tuesday's Drive Time, Cormac had quite the interview with John Bolton, former US National Security Advisor and Ambassador to the UN. And while he thinks Trump was mistaken in his decision to withdraw troops, and Joe Biden was also mistaken in enforcing this decision, on certain things, he was standing firm, very firm indeed.
Can I put to you a quote from a London Independent editorial? It says, "The answer is sad but simple. The West shored up a facade of democracy, but has shown once again that foreign arms and buckets of aid cannot build a shiny new state on stony ground." Would you go along with that?
Yeah, I've never believed in a nation-building project. We weren't there to make Afghanistan the Switzerland of Central Asia. We weren't there doing charity for the Afghan people. They enjoyed substantial amount of collateral benefits from our presence, and I'm glad that we were able to help out. But we were not there in a humanitarian intervention. We were there to defeat the terrorist threat to the United States, and for 20 years, that has succeeded. Now we're not there anymore, and I think the threat will recur.
I wonder, if you're not there for a nation building, for nation building reasons, I mean, does the reasons of self-interest, does that work as well? Because if you look at the period since the Second World War, be it from Vietnam to Iraq to Afghanistan, there are various examples where U.S. foreign intervention simply backfired or didn't work.
You want to name one?
Well, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan.
No, I think in Vietnam, we withdrew because of the failure of will in the Democratic Party. But I think that the activity while we were there did prevent the fall of all of Southeast Asia and beyond to the communists. I think in Iraq, we overthrew Saddam Hussein, who was a threat to peace and security in the Middle East, and I think that was very important to do. Look, you can't judge foreign policy simply by this event or that event. Over a long period of time, the United States and NATO, which of course Ireland is not part of, but which benefits from it, has stood for order and security and peace in the world. And a lot of people like to criticize the United States. It's a favorite sport around the world. And I would just say, if you keep doing it, you know, you might get a majority in the United States sometime when isolationism returns. And you know what? You will regret it when it happens.
And who are you talking to when you say that, John?
The people who criticize the United States.
But whatever your view of US intervention and withdrawal, the people in Afghanistan were waking up to a new reality and a hope that perhaps the Taliban might keep their promise of respect for human rights within the rules of Islamic Sharia law. On Tuesday's Morning Ireland, Bilal Sawari, a journalist based in Kabul, spoke to Paul Cunningham.
Are they being believed when they give those reassurances, even from people like the son of Mullah Omar?
Well, this is the clear aim of the Taliban strategy, to make sure that people do believe them. They have been able to secure the surrenders of, provinces, major provincial capitals, and the surrender deals by governors because of such specific offers. And the Taliban, I think, also realize that they have learned from their mistakes of the 1990s. Today, they are the government. They are no more the shadow government. They control Afghanistan 100%. So perhaps it's in that sense that they want to, change, and then they want to offer everyone, a place in the government and in the society. It is no secret that they have been brutal, even around the provinces when there were, reports of executions and killings. But the Taliban leadership continues to appeal to its fighters to calm down. That brutality must end if they are to, have the support of the Afghan people and the region and the international community, because now they will need international legitimacy and funding. And the world is watching, the Afghan people are watching, and Taliban are very aware of this.
Well, the world's eyes may very well be on the Taliban, but not everyone was confident of this new regime. Veteran journalist Lynn O'Donnell, who left Kabul on Sunday, gave her view to Philip.
Lynn, that assurance from Mujahid yesterday about protecting women within the limits of Islam, should we take it at face value?
I don't think anything the Taliban say can be taken seriously at face value. They are liars. They are killers. They are the biggest drug dealing cartel in the world. Everything they say must be discounted. Those comments that he made yesterday came from a press conference, so-called, held at the government's media and information centre, which was built with millions of dollars of international money, and the head of which was murdered by the Taliban just a week ago. The Taliban came to the gates of Kabul on Sunday morning and said, "We will not enter." Hours later, gunmen were roaming around the streets. They say they respect women. In districts that they've gone into, they have closed schools, they have forced women to give up their jobs, they have issued lists of women and girls to be rounded up and married off to their fighters. That's nothing more or less than sex slavery and ethnic cleansing. Nothing that they say can be believed. They are liars, killers, drug dealers.
And that fear of the Taliban had led to panic and attempts to flee the country, with desperate scenes at the airport. One woman who did manage to escape was Meath teacher Aoife McManus. She spoke to Mary on Morning Ireland yesterday from Pakistan and described her journey to the airport with a police escort.
As it's the Taliban who are working with the police now, it's a Taliban escort, dramatic as it sounds, to help us to get as far as the airport. So they, cleared traffic in some way and brought us as close to the gate of the airport as possible. So then there are, thousands of Afghan people trying to also leave. You know, they're trying to make their way with their half-finished visa processes or whatever IDs that they have, and their families, to also try and get in the military side of the airport to leave. So we were very lucky. I saw other NGO and UN cars having to go back because they didn't reach the gates, but we managed to reach the gates somehow, and the US Marines came out to meet us and brought us in, and we were processed that way with everybody else. It was just, you know, several thousand people going, so it was quite a scene, and still hearing all the gunshots from outside the airport of, you know, people obviously still trying to push their way in from somewhere else, and the gunshots would have been into the air to control the crowd, but still, it's quite a surreal experience.
And she described the dawn flight out of Kabul.
Yeah, we took off at dawn, so I watched, you know, the dawn, like the sun come over the mountains, and, you know, just watched out the window as we took off over Kabul and took off over the city that I've watched as I've departed, you know, quite a few times at this point, always knowing I was coming back. And it was, yeah, very strange and a heavy feeling to think that so many colleagues that I work with, so many friends are there and won't have the opportunity to leave, or won't anytime soon. And just wondering what's next for them. And that just looking down at the city, even though you can't see any difference, just such a different city.
And what of the people and the activists left in Afghanistan? On the News at One, Brian spoke to Mary Akrami of the Afghan Women Network.
And you, Mary, are you determined, resolved to stay put, to remain in Afghanistan, at least for the moment?
If they don't accept me, and they don't tolerate, and they don't allow me, and they wanted to disturb by creating problems, or like searching my home, or to following me and to creating problems, that is difficult for me to stay here. But otherwise, as a one that I, because I love my country, I love my home, I love my people, I don't want to leave. Why I should leave?
And on Drive Time, Cormac spoke to Pashtani Durrani, founder and executive director of an NGO for girls' education. She had fled Kandahar on Friday and is currently in hiding.
How long will you be in hiding for, I wonder?
For now, I am trying to gather all my strength to fight back, to ask for a statement, to ask for a surety, and make sure that they do it. If not, then I will continue to be in hiding until I can figure out a way so that my students can continue with their education one way or the other. See, they're throwing at us all these different vague phrases, so we have to come up with solutions. If they're going to not let girls study in university, we're going to launch online classes. If they're not going to let them work in person, we're going to launch online working mechanisms for them. So for every problem that they create, I'm trying to find solution right now.
Mm-hmm. You're steadfast then, Pashtana, that you will continue your work in Afghanistan, in Kandahar, to educate young women and girls. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. Why would I abandon them because government changed, because a few men left ARG and a few men are in charge? They are not supposed to decide for me, not anymore. They decided in the past and it was chaotic. It backfired. Not anymore. We are educated. We know what our rights are. And I'm standing to fight back.
Pashtana Durrani on Tuesday's Drive Time. However, yesterday, the news was less than hopeful.
There is growing concern for people in Afghanistan who helped the international coalition after an intelligence paper for the United Nations reported that the Taliban are hunting them down. The report also said militants were screening people on their way to Kabul airport. The Taliban had repeatedly pledged over the last week that it will not seek revenge on its opponents. Christian Nelemon of the Norwegian UN Intelligence Centre led the report. He said the Taliban is targeting the families of those who refuse to give themselves up.
They have lists of individuals, and even within the very first hours of moving into Kabul, they began search of former government employees. And this is not the action of random Taliban groups seeking revenge. This involved issued written orders from the military commission of the Taliban. It involves actual intelligence, photographs and so on of the individuals they are searching for.
A grim, grim week. Back in a bit. Welcome back. You may know writer Emma McLysett from all kinds of places, but most likely perhaps as one of the creators of the very funny and very successful Aisling books. But when she came into Ryan on Wednesday, she was talking about something very different.
I had the unfortunate incidents to be released from 2 months in a psychiatric hospital, literally as the pandemic kicked off. So,
God, your timing is incredible.
The timing was like, it. Looking back, it's almost comical.
Yeah.
But I remember I spent 2 months in hospital from mid-January to mid-March 2020.
Yeah.
And the day before I was discharged was the day that Leo did his big speech about the schools closing and people had to stay away from each other. And I remember just because the number one thing when you're leaving somewhere like a psychiatric hospital is don't isolate yourself. Don't be on your own. Don't.
That's what they say?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
And I was just sitting there going,
it's solitary confinement.
OK, how's this going to work? And Sarah stepped in and was like, well, obviously, I'm going to be there for you and we're going to be there for you.
The Sarah in question is her Aisling co-author, Sarah Breen, and her very good friend.
I was in her bubble during the pandemic. She was my next of kin when I needed somebody to be a next of kin. I just feel like I can count on her.
So I went out to meet you guys before you came in and she introduced herself as your support dog. Oh, come on. That's unfair on both of you. But she's
great on the lead.
That's for another day.
Oh, that's a good friend. Now, Emer had been in St. Pat's in Dublin in the eating disorder ward. And as she told Ryan, she had serious issues around food for over 20 years. But it had all come to a head about 2.5 years ago.
I was very black and white in terms of food. I was either terrified of eating it or couldn't stop thinking about eating it. It was one or the other and there was no in between. So it got to a point where it was causing so much distress in my life and it was like the only thing I could kind of think of or worry about, or, you know, it was stopping me from leaving the house. It was all I could think of was if I wasn't losing weight, that was a problem. If I wasn't I couldn't maintain a weight. It was years of it building up and building up. And I eventually kind of cracked and went, I have to do something about this.
Did you want to eat? Or did you want to not eat? Did you want to purge? Did you want to not purge?
It kind of depended on the cycle. So
chaotic.
Very chaotic. Some eating disorders go in cycles. So they call it like the binge purge cycle. My cycles were quite long. So that my binge cycles would be quite long. And then my restrict cycles would be quite long. So I would go through maybe months of kind of overeating, very rapid weight gain, and then months of starvation, overexercise, that kind of thing.
And despite all of this, hospital, she thought it might have been a step too far.
I was kind of in disbelief. I didn't think I would end up in hospital. I thought hospital was for people who were starving themselves to death.
Okay.
And I wasn't at that time. So I was really kind of shocked and I was like, oh, they really think this is serious. But part of the eating disorder and part of kind of mental illness is I'm not sick enough for this. They've got it wrong. You know, I've somehow tricked them into thinking that I'm sick enough for them to give me this care. And I remember saying that to one of them and they were like, think of how many hoops you had to jump through to get here. Do you really think all those people made a mistake? And I was like, I still kind of do. Yeah.
What a vicious mind game you're.
Oh, it's hurt. And even when I was in hospital, I was like, I don't deserve to be here. Like,
really?
Well, I'm taking up a bed that someone else deserves. And they were like, you wouldn't be here if you weren't sick enough to be here. Like, it's.
Were you embarrassed?
I was kind of, and it was because of my type of eating disorder. Like when people hear eating disorders, they usually think a very emaciated, usually a woman, probably a young woman who, you know, can't eat or won't eat or is terrified to eat. And I didn't present as that kind of person, even though I have been that person. But I've never been an emaciated, obviously very sick person, but I have been doing all the things that those people do. So I was kind of embarrassed because I assumed I was going to be the only bigger person on the ward. I was embarrassed to tell people I was going in for an eating disorder because I felt like they'd look at me going, you don't look like you have any, like, what? Yeah. That doesn't match up.
Yeah.
So I think I didn't tell that many people I was going in, but I think for some of it, I was like, oh, just kind of general mental health. What I've learned about eating disorders is that it's rarely just the eating disorder. There's usually some kind of co-illness that goes along with it, be it depression, anxiety, bipolar, you know, borderline personality disorder, something like that.
But she got help, made it through her time and was discharged. right into the dark end of the pandemic, it must be said. So how is she now? Because as she was at pains to point out, with something like this, there's no easy fix.
So who am I meeting today? Am I meeting showbiz Emer, or am I meeting Emer in recovery, or a combination of the two?
I think it's a combination of the two.
Because you're still, you and still have you, that comic edge.
There
and
isn't
yet
often
I can see
a combination of the two.
Is that right?
When I stop to think about it, I'm like, it does feel like a combination of the two, because I am telling stuff from, like, as I call her, back Emer, and but front Emer is the one who's here.
It's like a Marvel kind of anti-hero comic, yeah.
Yeah.
And how would you describe yourself mood-wise at the moment and recovery-wise?
Recovery-wise is difficult. So I thought, like, I foolishly thought going into St. Pat's I'd come out a new person. Like, oh, I'll be totally fixed. Fixed.
Like the car
fixed.
Is fixed.
And something I find very frustrating in there is they were so dogged in telling you, this is going to take a long time. Yeah. This is not going to be fixed overnight. This may not be your first admission. This may not be your only admission. You know, at the moment, I feel like I'm still very much in early recovery, which is frustrating because I've lived with this for 20 plus years and feel like I've like wasted a lot of time to it or given a lot of time over to it. I'm like, I don't want to give any more time.
Yeah.
But I don't really have an option. So I would say I'm like okay recovery wise. Like it's very up and down. They always say recovery isn't linear. So it's like a daily struggle. It's, you know, you don't know when you get up in the morning if that's going to be a good day or a bad day. But my mood is pretty okay.
Yeah, good.
Like, yeah.
I love your honesty. Thank you for no, but seriously, thank you for not dressing it up.
Yeah.
And saying, yeah, it's great to come out and find a great, you know, I really appreciate it because I think that's an honesty that... when you talk about mental health in this country, when I was growing up, just it was undiscussed.
Yeah.
And everyone just went, no, you put the head down. Or, you know that expression, you just take to the bed and hope to...
Yeah.
But I love what you're...
Suffering with their nerves or something like
that. Suffering with
yeah.
your nerves. Like what you've done today is just so gloriously honest.
Honesty in spades, Emer McLysett with Ryan. Now, our vaccination programme is flying. Positively smug we are with the take-up. But in some quarters, the jab has taken on religious significance. Step up, Christina Gallagher, who leads the House of Prayer on Achill Island, County Mayo. She is a self-professed visionary who claims to receive messages from both the Virgin Mary and Jesus. Margaret and Joe delved into the nuance of one particular message.
Your world has with, and this is a message for Mary, isn't it? Because she begins, my daughter, write down all that I tell you. It is important. And Christina is the daughter for all the people of the world. This is Mary speaking, apparently. Your world has with it the deepest darkness of hell, the Antichrist. How so many bow down to his power. Yet even more will do so in a short time. You will all be called into the suppression and dictatorship of Antichrist. You will be called upon to receive the vaccine. That is death. And the mark of the beast will be forced upon you. Those who willingly receive it will die unto eternity.
She makes the point. It's very subtle there. It said that it will be followed by the mark of the beast. It doesn't say the vaccine is the mark of the beast. That's a subtle point.
But
there
it does say
you read that message again.
You will be. We presume when she's talking about the vaccine, Margaret, she's talking about the COVID vaccine, isn't she?
She's talking about the COVID vaccine, but you're reading the thing there. She has not said that the COVID vaccine is the mark of the beast. Neither has the Lord said that.
No, she said...
She's
gone further. She said, you will be called upon to receive the vaccine. That is death. You can't get clearer than that.
But that is not what the attack said on Sunday last, which I'm just speaking about that particular attack. That particular text said that Christine McGallow has said in the House of Prayer that the vaccine is the mark of the beast and that anybody who takes it will be lost to hell. She has not said that, and neither does the message
say
that.
Well, we rang.
That was Tuesday's Live Line. By Wednesday, things had hotted up in the House of Prayer.
And they have on their website this morning... attack on RTE Liveline. False claims are repeated despite the clarity of the disclaimer beneath. No such thing has ever been said by Christina, nor do such remarks appear on her website.
In response, Joe too was getting hot under the collar, as was Mary.
So if you get the vaccine, you were aligning your, well, you die, but you're aligning, according to this, you are aligning yourself with Satan. Is that your understanding? What is
the
your
mark of the beast? If you get the mark of the beast, you're aligning yourself with Satan.
But if you get the vaccine, you'll get the mark of the beast.
No.
So what's the vaccine got to do with it?
The vaccine, in a way, is leading to, people will get used to going, and they'll bring in, I saw this on just a few days ago on, I think it was Fox News or something, that even in America, the government are now talking about this microchip.
What?
And this is a chip, this is a microchip which is going to be put into your hand, and they're going to bring it in as a way of detecting.
And Mary,
the virus.
Have you got the vaccination?
Have I got it?
Yes, do you mind me?
No.
What about people of faith, quite prominent people, who have gotten the vaccination?
Pope Francis.
Yes.
Has got the vaccine.
Yes.
So he's been misled by the scientists, has he?
Well, I cannot speak for him, but he hasn't taken the mark of the beast. And that's the important thing. It's important that people will know this, this microchip that's coming, Joe. That's important to let people know that.
Well, we'll cross that microchipped bridge when we're over it, Mary.
Coming soon enough, you know.
Would Jesus have got the vaccine?
He wouldn't need it because he had no. Jesus was never ill.
Okay.
Not necessarily the case, said Catherine.
Your caller there commented that Jesus was never ill. The theology of Christianity tells us that Jesus was human and divine, and that he suffered humanely in the human sense, in the same way as he suffered. You know, we're told there's nothing that Jesus in his lifetime didn't go through that we as human beings don't go through ourselves. And he was divine as well. So, and I'm not denying the divinity of Jesus. I'm a practicing Christian myself. But I think it's very wrong to assume that Jesus didn't have a cough or a cold or flu in his lifetime. You know, he did, you know, according to scripture, he did incredible ministry. And I'm sure there were times when Jesus maybe felt burned out. Even as a human, he wept at the death of his best friend, you know. So he was very human, you know, in the sense.
First of all, I never said that Jesus didn't suffer. Of course, Jesus suffered the ultimate, more than anybody will ever suffer.
No, you said Jesus never got sick.
And I said he never got ill. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't get tired. He got tired, he got lonely, he got everything.
Yeah, and there's a good chance he could have been ill in his lifetime. There's no scriptural basis to say that Jesus was ill or wasn't ill. We don't know. There's bits of the scripture.
You don't know. But Jesus certainly suffered.
Patricia phoned in, and overall, she was just having none of it.
I wouldn't be concerned about medieval rubbish on websites. What concerns me is that anyone would make an announcement for people not to get vaccinated against this virus, because all the proof and what's happened over the last 17 months proves that the only way to get out of this pandemic is to be vaccinated. And the proof of that is that most of the people in hospital at the moment are people who have not been vaccinated. Mm.
And on it went. The conversation was a wide-ranging one and included a prediction from Joe.
Let me say, OK, people write this down. Yeah. Joe Duffy said on August the 18th, 2021, that there will be storms and earthquakes and there will be forest fires and natural disasters and building collapses all over the world within the next 12 months. And 12 months hence, I hope I don't have to, but 12 months hence, on this day, this day in 12 months, I will be able to stand up here in this studio as I now am, and I'll be able to say, didn't I tell you? Didn't I tell you 12 months ago this we will be struck down?
Yeah, well, she said a lot of things a long time before
Joe
that.
Joe Duffy
example.
Is talking bull.
Joe Duffy talking bull? Surely not. A date for the diary for all of us. But this whole conversation started around the issue of vaccines. It finished thus.
People. I've got the vaccine, Mary. As you know, I'm deeply, deeply sceptical, not just of Christina Gallagher, but I'm deeply, deeply upset by older people, older vulnerable people following her and believing her and not getting the vaccine. What is going to happen to me?
What's going to happen to you? listen, I'm going. Goodbye, and God bless.
Talk to Joe. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Sound, the superior sense. Of course, coming from the bowels of the Radio Centre, we would say that, wouldn't we? But when lecturer at the National Film School in Dunleary, Stephen Benedict, spoke to Kay on Arena, he argued that when it comes to the big cinematic experience, sound is crucial. Despite Kay putting this to him.
The cliche or the belief that film is a visual medium.
Yeah, I think that cliche dates back to, as you said, from the silent era from 1927, the transition to sound. And it came from filmmakers who were vehemently against the advent of sound. They claimed that that sound would ruin the art of film. They said it's a visual medium. I'm sure they shouted that very, very loudly. But the thing is that people who say, for me, the people who say the film is a visual medium, they're missing half the picture. And the other half is sound.
And he gave a few examples. Take a listen to these helicopters from Apocalypse Now, directed by Francis Ford Coppola, with sound design by pioneer Walter Murch.
So if we see helicopters and hear that, we know it's helicopters, but it is helicopter sound, is it?
Yeah, but that's the really important thing. I'm glad you picked up on that, because that doesn't sound like a real helicopter in real life.
No.
But in the context of the film, it feels real. It's disorientating, it's dreamlike, yet it works, because Coppola and Murch realised that film sound does not have to relate to real life. It only needs to relate to what feels real.
So it's not sound effects of the sound we know.
Completely. I mean, it's warped and it's completely manipulated and it's distressed and it's stretched and turned inside out. So if we think of it in these terms, in the cinema screen only simulates space, the length of the width of the screen, and also the depth. But the depth is only an illusion. Okay. Everything that is depicted on screen is the same distance from you, the viewer, no matter how big or how small the object is. If you're looking at a movie set in space or a domestic drama, it's still the same distance from you on the screen. But what the sound does is that it fills the space between yourself and the screen. If you'll excuse the pun, the sound adds volume to the space between yourself and the screen, and hearing the sounds that fill the space adds to the emotional textures. So what you when you hear it, you feel it. Now, I mean that quite literally, because sound vibrates through the body. Okay, so sound can really add to the emotional texture and contours of a scene.
And there was more. Have a listen to this closely.
I've given your producers a sound clip.
Yes, I love this. Yeah,
Schindler's
you've
List.
Given us two clips, in fact.
Yeah.
Compare and contrast.
Yes, before and after. So the scene we're going to listen to from Schindler's List is Oscar Schindler, played by Liam Neeson. He's talking to Itzhak Stern, played by Ben Kingsley. And he's inviting him, he's pushing him to gather members of the Jewish community into investing whatever money they have left. Their properties have already been confiscated by the Nazis, to invest in his factory. In other words, Schindler is a war profiteer. And he's looking for slave labor. So if we listen to the first version.
Let me understand. They put up all the money. I do all the work. What if you don't mind my asking, would you do?
I'd make sure it's known the company's in business. I'd see that it had a certain panache. That's what I'm good at. Not the work. Presentation.
Okay.
So now, Kay, if we listen to it again, but this time, if you listen now to it, there's a particular sound between not the work, the presentation, you're going to hear something else.
Let me understand. They'd put up all the money. I'd do all the work. What if you don't mind my asking, would you do?
I'd make sure it's known the company's in business. I'd see that it had a certain panache. That's what I'm good at. Not the work. The presentation.
What's okay. That's
the sound of Schindler's leather coat. He's sitting forward on a desk and he spreads his arm wide to impress Stern with his presentation. But for me, it's more than just a sound. There's emotional value to it. Schindler isn't physically threatening Stern, but what Stern hears is the emotional value of a creaking rope at the end of which hangs his life precariously in the balance. Because if you watch the film, Stern is so shocked by not the words, but what he's just heard. It takes him all of 20 seconds to reply. Not a word is spoken in that time, but you don't notice the silence because of the emotional weight, the impact. And that only works with the of his leather coat.
And would we have, we wouldn't have noticed that.
No, but I think if you took it out, you wouldn't notice. But when it's in there, you're responding to its subliminal value. And I think that's the essence of sound. It's poetic in a film.
Stephen Benedict on Arena, you will never listen in the same way again. And staying on the power of sounds, here is a special recording from the Macaulay Library at Cornell University for Mooney Goes Wild.
The sounds you've just heard of bearded seal, American toad, scissor grinder cicada, and long-tailed manakin.
Ooh, that's quite amazing. And speaking of amazing, hark back to Saturday. Might this be the sound of victory and perhaps vengeance?
I'm just remarking here, the green and red of Mayo is playing here, and the atmosphere with the Mayo supporters is incredible. The Mayo team have stayed in the middle of the field. Dublin are trudging off, and it's a very, very special occasion for Mayo people. Listen to this.
On the way, oh, boo! Yes, we won. And Dublin, oh, was it hard to lose in Croke Park? Did it not feel good? Next stop, Sam. But come Monday, they were all swapping the blue for the green and red. No loyalty at all.
This morning is Mayo's morning, isn't it? I mean, watching that match, which I watched from the very beginning to the very, very end, cheering, because, you know, the Galway in me with it still has the love of Mayo next door. And I would have to say that it felt like it was long, long after time for them to have a go. And sure enough.
Have a go. We won.
It was scintillating. And I thought the whole thing was over at halftime. I thought, do I bother going back? Well, wasn't I the fool to even underestimate the passion?
Fool's a little strong one, but, you know. Even Carlo's Catherine Thomas was angling to hitch a lift on the Mayo bus.
Gotta start with Mayo and say a massive congrats. What a match. And I imagine there are a lot of happy heads all the way from Ballina to Belmullet to Ballycastle. And rightly so. 1 million people tuned in to watch Mayo beat the Dubs. Mayo beat the Dubs. Mayo beat the Dubs. Mayo beat the Dubs.
Ooh, glitch in the system.
Mayo beat the Dubs.
I don't know why that keeps playing. Wouldn't want to be childish about it. Oh, and before we forget, the hurling.
Limnock aboo. Up Cork.
Good luck to all. But back to Mayo, why wouldn't we? And one man heading to Belmullet and the golf course.
Bill Murray. What's the crack?
You there? Hello?
Yes. Catherine? How are you getting on? Okay. How are you enjoying the trip?
How are we enjoying the trip? Except for we're all wearing sunglasses. Let's still get that right out, but pretty much.
It was a late night.
It's the blinding sunshine. Are you kidding?
Okay.
No, we are, you know how you kind of hypnotize yourself to believe it's like your dream's going to come true?
Yes.
We got sunglasses on in the hope that when we hit the water, that the sun is going to be there. We're going to catch a sunset or... the man driving this is not so... he doesn't inspire confidence.
No.
So there's a good chance that when we hit the water, we're going to see a sunrise.
Now, Bill Murray was on a bus, along with what seemed like the entire Bill Murray family and extended family, and a few hangers-on, including poets.
Oh, hold on. We just got word that the poet laureate of the United States, Mr. Billy Collins, has a poem he'd like to read you.
Hang on.
Great.
Hang on. If it's drive time, if people are driving their cars right now, I'd like you to pull over to the side of the road rather than risk any kind of emotional outbreak that might involve a collision and some sort of legal action. Okay, Mr. Billy Collins.
Hi there. How are you?
Hey, Billy. How are you?
I'm very well. Never better. Now, here's a little poem. It's only 8 lines long. It's called No Time.
Are you ready? Yes.
Okay. All right, I'm going for it. No time. In a rush this weekday morning, I tap the horn as I speed past the cemetery where my parents are buried side by side beneath a slab of smooth granite. Then all day long, I think of him rising up to me a look, knowing disapproval, while my mother calmly tells him to lie back down. How's that?
You're getting a round of applause from the whole of Ireland here. Thank you. What a privilege.
A busload of applause. Turning it back to Bill.
Catherine, I can't tell you how lucky you are to have the poet laureate of the United States, Billy Collins, read a poem to you, and how lucky you are that he read a short one. That was the Lord's mercy. There's a gentle rain of grace falling upon you, all of us, for that.
Now, poetry is lovely, but you are here, Bill, to swing that club. So,
how good a golfer are you?
How good a golfer am I?
Yeah.
You know, Kathleen, you don't ask someone like how much money they earn or, you know, are you seeing anyone else? But how good? I'm good enough. I was better. And yesterday I was not so good. But then late yesterday, I became quite a bit better.
And we can only speculate as to how. And of course, we had to get some of the old Begara and Begob culinary classics into the chat.
I'm a fan of a potato, but I've never had a tato before. And everyone in this bus, no one slept well, partly because they were thinking about tatos, and I think partly because they'd eaten tatos.
And you know what, Bill? Do you know what you've got to do, Bill, as well? You've got to have a tato, cheese and onion tato sandwich. So you've got to get white bread, loads of butter, pour a packet of tato crisps in there, smash it together, pint of Guinness, and honestly, it'll be the best meal you've ever had.
Now, here's Catherine. Guys, Catherine here says, what you really have to do is, you've got to make a tato sandwich. You've got to take some white bread, slather it with butter, fill it with tatoes, and then a pint of Guinness. Now, why does every recipe have to end with a pint of Guinness? It's not fair. You're not helping the situation on the bus here, Catherine. You're not helping. I thought it was a cooking show, and it's not. It's just another Irish show. It's brutal. You got me. You pulled us into your trap. You lured us in.
And you know
vixen.
What?
You're a vixen. You are.
I'm raging because I'm actually going to Belmullet on Friday. Will you still be there on Friday?
Hold on a second. She's coming to Balmoral on Friday. We're going to be gone, right? But we're not going to be gone. Can we get ourselves out gone by now?
We'll
be away. We'll be in Denmark.
Matt Damon, so 2020. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. And if you do spot Bill Murray skulking around, just don't let him near the karaoke machine.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing fallen leaves in the night. Who can say where they're blowing as free as the wind? Hopefully learning why the sea on the tide has no way of turning. More than this, you know there's nothing. More than this, tell me one thing.